I would like to begin by acknowledging Jake and Karen Abelevitz for sponsoring the lunch and the learning today. And the learning and everything should be Le'ilui Nishmas, Eliyahu ben Abba, and Leah bas Avraham. Okay. So if you open up your Chumashim, I'd like to take a look, if you noticed how I entitled the sheet that I gave you, the Yehuda and Tamar interlude. So let's take a look at, in fact, the Parsha. Open up Parshas Vayesha. And if you look at Parshas Vayesha, just a very cursory look at the Parsha, we will see that the vast majority of the Parsha is, as Chaim pointed out, right, the story of Yosef. Right, we have Yosef, let's see. Start from the beginning of the Parsha. We could just review it rather quickly. Okay, page 198. All right, so 198, 199. All right, so we begin our Parsha. Yaakov lives in the land of Canaan, and the beginning, Yosef has his dreams, and the brothers don't like it, and they gang up on him, and that story has its ins and outs, and ultimately they sell him down to Egypt, and his father thinks, and ultimately they sell him down to Egypt, and his father thinks that he's dead, and in Egypt, Yosef goes through ups and downs, and Yosef is at the top of his game, he's at the bottom of his game, he's at the top of his game. Yosef has a lot of ups and downs in Egypt. He's in jail multiple times. His life is a real whirlwind. And the very end of our parsha is Yosef in jail, interpreting the dreams of the butler and the baker, setting the stage for his release and for his ascending once again, finally, to the position of great power. Now, that's all the story of Yosef. But on page 208, Perek Lamed Ches, we have this story of Yehuda and Tamar, which is apparently an interlude, right? It is seemingly unconnected and disrelated, or disrelated and unconnected to the story of Yosef. So let's take a brief look at this story, and then I would like to look at it more in depth. But let's just take a top level view. Top of page 208. At that time, Yehuda goes down from his brothers. He turned away toward an Adulamite man whose name was Chira. And Judah saw the daughter of a prominent merchant whose name was Shua. He married her and he consorted with her.
She has two children, Er and Onan.
And she has a third son, and his name was Shela, and it was in Kziv when she bore him. Vayhi Er b'chor Yehuda Rabbi Ne'ashem v'yemiteu Hashem. Er was killed by God for some evil deed, right? Which is not explicit in the text. Vayomer Yehuda la'onan bo eleishes achicha v'yabemos avakem zera achicha. And Yehuda says to Onan, go be intimate with your brother's wife, engage with her in Yibum, the Levirate marriage, and you will bear offspring in your brother's name. And he refused to marry or to engage in his Levirate marriage with his brother's wife. 10. Vayera b'ne Hashem, and Hashem did not like this either. Vayames gamoso. So now Aaron and Onan are both gone. Vayomer Yehuda l'Tamar kalatel shvi almana beis avicha digdal shela b'ni ki amar pen yamut ki gam hu ki achav vatelech Tamar vateshev beis avicha. And now Yehuda says to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shela grows up. And he figured that, lest he also die like his brother. So Tamar went and lived in her father's house.
But of course, as we know, the story continues. Vayirbo hayamim, vatamas bashua eshes Yehuda, vayinachem Yehuda, vayal al gozes etzono, hu v'chir ereu adulami. Pasuk says, many days passed, and Shua's daughter, the wife of Yehuda, died. When Yehuda was consoled, he went up to oversee his sheep sharers, he and his Adulamite friend. So, vayugad l'tamar lemor. And now Tamar finds out what was going on. Hinecha mi cholel Timnasa, your father-in-law is going up to Timna. Batasar bigdei almanusa, and now she entraps him, right? And she entraps him, and she sleeps with him, and he sleeps with her. It's a consensual relationship. Vayet eleha al derech vayomer havana avo elayach ki lo yada ki chalaso he. He didn't know that it was his daughter-in-law. And ultimately, pasuk 20, by Yishlach Yehuda es gedi ayizim biyad re'eu adulami lo mitza'a. His daughter-in-law is accused of being a harlot, and ultimately, Yehuda is going on the bandwagon to convict her. By Yomer Yehuda tikach la pen yina lavuz. And it was about 3 months had passed, and Judah was told, your daughter-in-law Tamar has committed adultery. Judah said, take her out and let her be burned. And then she showed him the identifying clothing that he would recognize the gifts that he had given her when he thought she was a harlot. And he is bested by her. He recognizes this. She is right. And he was not intimate with her anymore. And it came to pass, at the time she gave birth, behold, there were twins in her womb. And it happened that she gave birth, one put out a hand. The midwife took a thread and tied it around his hand. This one emerged first, and then he drew back his hand, and behold, the other one emerged. The first one was called Peretz. And afterwards, his brother, who had originally emerged his hand, he was called Zerach. And this ends the interlude of Yehuda and Tamar. So the overall question becomes, what is the significance of this interlude to the bigger story here? It's not like we have five stories in the Parsha. We have one story in the Parsha, one long story in the Parsha. What is the significance of this story of Yehuda and Tamar in the greater story of Yosef, his difficulty with his brothers, his being sold down to Egypt, and his being in jail multiple times in Egypt? It seems really to be entirely disconnected. So, yeah.
So I'm thinking that what's going to go further from Bnei Yisrael is going to be not good after Yosef grows up, gets big in Mitzrayim, and then ultimately we have the whole slavery and all that. So I think that this is kind of like, because from this seed comes who?
From whose seed comes?
From Tamar and good stuff come from this eventually.
Eventually.
Right. But I think that that's why it was placed here, to show that as bad as you think things could get, here we're giving you this little show that a seed will come from this offspring that will eventually be the savior for it.
Okay, so one possibility here is that it really has nothing to do with the story per se.
Not exactly.
But it is there in order to the Jewish approach that God provides the refuah before the makkah. Right? So we're seeing here that even though we're about to go down to Egypt, there's going to be a lot of difficulty, a lot of tsaros, and there's going to be slavery, but ultimately, there is going to be redemption, sovereignty, Jewish monarchy, because ultimately the Jewish monarchy emerges from this union many centuries later, from this union of Yehuda and Tamar, their offspring, ultimately David HaMelech emerges. So Bryony's suggesting that this is really here, not because it has anything to do with the story per se, but it's a message of hope. They shouldn't be disheartened. So this is for the reader, right? For the reader, to feel that way. Of course, the reader knows, I guess the Chumash, prior, when it was, in other words, the reader knows the end of the story here.
So like, why, you know, why do we need, why does the reader need this this message? Maybe it's a broader message, not specifically to this story, but you should just know this is a phenomenon in general. Okay? So that's certainly one possibility. Take a look, the sheet that I gave you, the booklet that I gave you, and let's take a look. Actually, we'll start with Rashi. Let's start with Rashi in your Chumash. So Rashi says, "Lama nismecha parsha zo l'chan." Why is this parsha? Why is this section of the Chumash of Yehuda and Tamar? Why is it here? The hifsik b'farshaso shel Yosef and breaks up the whole story of Yosef. And Rashi says, "Lilamed shehoriduhu achiv echav migdulaso kisherau b'tzara savihem." To tell us that the brothers horiduhu echav migdulaso, they removed him from his position of prominence. He's, you know, Yehuda is very significant. The horiduhu, and they removed him from his position of prominence. Kishira'u b'tzaras avihem. Amru, they said, ata amrata l'machro, you, Yehuda, told us to sell Yosef rather than to kill him. Ilu amart l'hashivo, hayinu shomim lach. Had you, Yehuda, told us to save him and to bring him back to our father, we would have listened to you. In other words, they critique him for not using his position. Yehuda was a very important of the brothers, right? Yehuda tayoducha achecha, right? Yaakov ultimately tells us Yehuda is very significant, and they take him down for apparently not using his position appropriately. They sort of divest the responsibility for what they did on Yehuda. We sold him because you told us to. Now they see that their father is inconsolable, and they're upset at Yehuda for not telling them to save Yosef altogether. So Rashi tells us that the story of Yehuda and Tamar is really telling us the consequence of the story of Mechiras Yosef. It is not a story which is unrelated to our parsha, like Briny, like you were suggesting, which I think is correct. Also, that's correct.
I'm just giving you
I'm saying that it's a different approach. This is saying it's not related to the story per se. Overall, it has an idea of hope and so on. But Rashi's saying is that it is intimately connected to the story of Yosef. That this is precisely the reason that he left, the reason that he went down, is because his brothers took him down a notch. And so, you know, he separated from them for a while. And the reason that Horidu, the reason that they took him down, as it were, is because of the fact that they held him responsible, which is a little weird.
Yeah.
They hold him responsible for their father's pain, which is a consequence of their own actions. Yeah, in a certain way, that's precisely what it sounds like, and that's really difficult to accept. But nevertheless, that is certainly one approach in Rashi. And Rashi's position, his approach, also works out very nice textually, right? Why does it work out nice textually? Because they say horiduhu, that Yosef was taken down to Egypt, right? Yosef was taken down to Egypt. The brothers, hold on a second. Yeah, the brothers sort of deposed him from his position of leadership, and Yosef is deposed in a certain way. He is brought down. Yehuda is brought down. So there's like a textual connection over here that Yehuda, you know, Yehuda goes down. Yehuda's going down is a consequence of Yosef's going down. So like there's a nice textual connection here that underlies Rashi's idea. So this is an idea, but it has like a textual basis to it. The idea of going down connected to going down. Yehuda's going down is connected to Yosef's going down. Yerida. Okay, so that's one possible. So we have two possibilities here. One is the idea of hope. One is number two is the idea that that this story is a consequence of Yehuda and his brothers. Okay, but let's take a look and I don't think you have it here right in front of you, but actually we'll go to that next. Let's take a look at the Ibn Ezra. So the Ibn Ezra here, which you have in on your page, what? Yes, here's a copy. So the Ibn Ezra says the following. Ibn Ezra says, "Vayihi ba'et ahi, it was at this time, ein zot ha'et ka'asher nimkar Yosef, rak kodem himachro." Ibn Ezra says, a third approach. This is not an interlude. It's only an interlude in the way the text has it. But in reality, historically speaking, in the order of the Seder, the order of events, this was Kodem Himachro. This story of Yehuda and Tamar happens prior to the whole story of Yosef being sold. And so in that sense, it is not an interlude per se. It just happens to be, sort of, textually out of order. But really, this happened beforehand. Ukamol misham naso hagad gada, and from there, everything flowed forth. Ba'ei sahu hivdil Hashem et shevet Halevi, v'shevet Halevi nivchar b'shana ashenis. All right. So that's the main point that I wanted to take from the Ibn Ezra. So the Ibn Ezra sort of resolves the problem by saying it's no problem at all. Of course.
That it happened
before Yosef was sold. So it resolves the problem in the sense that the story happens beforehand, but the problem is retained because the text actually has it here. So Ibn Ezra goes through a whole thing, but for our purposes, I just want to see that. Now take a look at the Sforno, which you have both in English and in Hebrew, on page 2. And the Sforno says the following. Vayihi ba'esahi. At about the same time when Joseph was sold to Egypt, at the suggestion of Yehuda, who had proposed this instead of bringing him back to his father, and had therefore bereaved his father, Yehuda reaped some of the fruit of his ill-advised plans, in that the way was paved for him to be bereaved of two of his own sons in due course. What? Mida keneged mida. Right? So over here, we have here the Ibn Ezra, right? And the Ibn Ezra says that the story is, out of order. Okay, so I have 1, 2, 3. I'm going to put a fourth one over here. The Sforno says, if you think this is integrally connected to the story, you don't know how integrally connected it is. That the story of Yehuda with two sons dying is not just here haphazard. This is a measure-for-measure punishment. That Yehuda's two sons were killed as a consequence. Let's read it again. Yehuda, who had proposed this instead of bringing back to his father and thereby bereaved his father, Yehuda reaped some of the fruit of his ill-advised plans in the way was paved for him for to be bereaved of his own sons. So his children, the Sforno says,
that this story is here to teach us about the death slash measure for measure punishment of Yehuda's sons, Aaron Onan.
So Sparta is suggesting that Yehuda was responsible because it didn't happen to him.
Yes, he's suggesting that Yehuda is entirely responsible. Well, I guess not entirely responsible, but he bears Yehuda bears responsibility. He bears responsibility. Okay, yes.
In each story, each brother was trapped by a woman for different reasons.
Okay, go on.
I see a relationship also.
Okay, perfect. Hold that thought. We are going to come back to that very, very, very shortly. Excellent, okay? Let's take a look at the Tur HaAruch on the bottom of page 2. Also, you have it in English. It says, it was at that time, according to Rashi, the reason why the Torah introduces this paragraph with these words is to tell us that Yehuda's demotion from his position of leadership, right? We saw that. Turn the page. Many commentators challenge Rashi's commentary, saying that 22 years elapsed from the sale of Joseph to the eventual reunion of the family. So Yosef is sold, and then there are 22 years of an interlude there. So let's figure it out and see if this all makes sense. So seeing that Joseph was 17 when he was sold, and he was 39 when the brothers and his father moved to Egypt. So we have a total. I'm no mathematician here, but how many years is that? That's 22 years, right? So we have a 22-year gap. Seeing that only so few years had elapsed, how could Yehuda have married, sired 3 sons, married off 2 of them, and have married Tamar and become the father of Zerach and Peretz siring Chetzron and Chamuel, all within such a short space of time? 22 years is not a short space of time, but for all that to happen, again, what did Rashi say? Rashi said that this happened as a consequence of Yehuda's bad judgment, so he went down and he was demoted from his position. Now, and that's just after, apparently, Yosef is sold. That means that everything in this story has to have occurred in 22 years. What is the likelihood, and he's not the only one, the Torah Aruch is not the only one, many commentaries make the same challenge against Rashi. What's the likelihood that this could have occurred? So again, if you held like Ibn Ezra, and you say, well, it occurred beforehand, so you get rid of that problem, you still have the problem of what's it doing here, right? So let's go a little further. So he says, in fact, Ibn Ezra writes, That what is related here occurred before the sale. So that's how Ibn Ezra deals with this one challenge of Rashi. And that the story was interrupted in order to contrast the story of Yehuda and Tamar with that of Yosef and his wife Potiphar. Okay. I'm sorry, the wife of Potiphar. So he says the following. And again, he's not the only one, but He came with English translation, so I figured it would be good to use him in our class, so everybody would be able to read along. So he says the following. The Torah says that the reason for the story of Yehuda and Tamar, it's not an interlude in the story. It does break from the previous story, but it sets the stage for the next part of the story to draw a contrast between Yosef and how he conducted himself with the wife of Potiphar, and how Yehuda conducted himself when enticed by a woman who was not his wife. But that's not what you were. Were you saying that? That's what you were saying. Okay. And who was Yosef? Yosef was a married woman, you're saying.
Yeah, he was taking his master's wife, who trusted him with everything, and of course she was a married
Okay, so all I will say is that the Torah writing, Torah Arachi writing Al Pi Pshat, the plain sense of the text is that, you know, whether whether you apply a halachic scrutiny and defend Yehuda being with this woman, he was married. At the end of the day, it is clear from the psukim that, you know, this was not a relationship to be proud of. Let's put it that way.
Right? He had as much sense to lose as Yosef had to lose if he'd gone with Potiphar's wife.
Right. So that's why, and that's why it's an even greater contrast. It's an even greater contrast because
it's a contrast.
That's exactly correct. Okay. So even more so. Yosef was able to withstand his urge.
But
Yehuda, one second. No, he actually had less reason.
Why?
Because
he was his master's wife. He would have lost everything. If he slept with his master's wife.
Actually, if you sleep with a master's wife, you probably are in a more powerful position than you were otherwise, right? Because now you are entirely hooked in. Everybody knows that, at least until modern times, right? When women ran the show. Now today, there's equality of the genders. So now women aren't quite as powerful as they used to be. But my point is that who's the most powerful person in any bureaucracy, in any government agency? Who's the most powerful person in Donald Trump's White House? The answer is his secretary, okay, the person most intimately connected to him and has his ear, and in Paro's household, in Potiphar's household, the wife, although she didn't hold an official position of power, but if you have it in with her, you have it in. I guess so. But that's not why he. But that's not why he didn't. In other words, I'm saying that's not what.
He didn't stop doing it because of that.
Right. It wasn't fear of Potiphar. I understand. So what I'm saying is that apparently being afraid of the boss is not powerful enough. Powerful enough. Deterrent. Thank you. It's not a powerful enough deterrent to stop you from going down that path. What stopped Yosef going down that path was his moral compass,
the image
of his father.
I don't know about so much morally going against Yehuda sleeping with the Kadesh.
I think that the clear indication of the psukim is that the Torah looks down upon what Yehuda did. And look, even in the society, when it turned out that his daughter-in-law had slept with somebody, he didn't say, oh, well, she's a single woman at this time, so we'll just let it go at that, right? So it's clearly it was considered a bad thing. So I'm just pushing back. I'm not saying that what your suggestion is totally wrong, but I think that the pshat of the psukim indicate that this contrast over here between Yosef and Yehuda. Or at least as the Torah understands it, and as Paulo was saying, that Yosef had Yosef was tested, and Yehuda was tested. Yehuda failed his test, and Yosef passed his test. And that's the story here of Yehuda and Tamar. Right? I would just suggest that up until now, none of these answers, I think, captures it fully, because if you say it's a question of hope, right? So really just get to the chase. Yehuda, Tamar, they had Zerach and Peretz, and ultimately, you know, David HaMelech came out of them. You don't need the whole back and forth and the intrigue. So Briney's answer is insufficient to me in that way. Rashi's answer is somewhat insufficient because, again, even though he says this is a consequence for what happened, so fine, this is a consequence for what happened, that he lost his leadership position, but really, all the details of this story are not necessary to make this point. Ibn Ezra. It's, Sforno, Measure for Measure. All right, that explains more of the story, but I still don't think it explains, you know, all of the story. The Ibn Ezra says that the story is out of order. So, you know, which is his way of resolving the problem by saying there's no problem. But there still is a problem because the Torah still puts it here, right? So even if historically it's out of order, right? So the Ibn Ezra says that it is, you know, to show this contrast. But again, you know, if it's to show this contrast, so it says a lot, but I don't think it says everything. Yeah.
So to show this contrast, he makes the claim that things that the Torah could hear did not happen in that time, but happened in the time frame that he prefers to suggest, so that his idea of linking these two pieces will go together. My question is, where does he get this from? Where does Ibn Ezra get it from that you can say, no, whatever it says here, that's not the order in which it happened? What is he basing it on, is my question.
In other words, how does he say that?
He's got a house of cards that's based on his idea that things that appear here, the order in which they appear here, is incorrect. That really it appeared way before. Really, where is that from?
Well, even if not way before, just before.
Right. Well, it says before the Mechira.
Right. Right. So, I don't know that that he has a proof per se, other than sound logic. Because you can't say, it's very hard to say that these events occurred in the 22-year gap. It's too much to have happened.
But nobody else makes that point or that concern.
Rashi didn't make that point, and that's why Ibn Ezra is arguing on him. that's why he's saying, you know, Rashi's got a problem. So I don't know how Rashi dealt with it, you know. You know, maybe Rashi felt that it could have happened in that amount of time. I don't know. I don't know. Yeah.
So let's say it then happened here in whatever the time frame was. Maybe the reason why they give you so much detail is because maybe Yehuda is the one responsible for the selling of Yosef.
Okay.
And maybe had he handled his situation differently at this point and used his, you know, deterrence not to have slept, maybe we wouldn't have needed an offspring. Maybe we would have never had Mitzrayim, that at that point it could have been done, that it would have been to help that whole selling. You understand that the selling would have been he would have maybe vindicated it, like maybe at this point. Do you understand? Evidently bad things are happening to him now.
Right.
Right? And maybe he, for some reason, didn't take Tamar at this point.
Right.
Maybe this was his test.
How is it a test for Yehuda?
Let's assume he didn't sleep with Tamar. He lost his son,
right.
Sold whatever, and this didn't happen. I don't know because the details are given. So maybe there's a reason why the details are given, because it wasn't the right thing to do. I'm taking it to hold
because it wasn't level. The right thing to do. It wasn't the right thing
right.
to do.
And had he not done it,
had he
done the right thing and not slept with her,
right.
Then we would. Then maybe somehow that would have been like the God would have taken that as a to right the wrong that he did by selling
right.
Yosef.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Completely not connected to anything anybody's saying. I'm so much away connected, but. We're ignoring Tamar as a character. And I think this important aspect is that she risked everything because she wanted to have a child. I'm not sure how it connects, but it's an important aspect.
You make a good point. That, in other words, maybe the story here is not about the Yehuda part of the story and about him per se, but rather it's about Tamar. That the length that she goes in order to ensure that, you know, her, really to ensure that her husband's line continues, because otherwise she could marry anybody,
right?
So you could say, it's a very interesting point, Judy, and you could argue that this story of Yehuda and Tamar actually stands as a counterpoint to the previous, as a counterpoint to the sale of Yosef. What? Right. They try to kill him off, and look how far she goes. Look how far she goes to ensure the line of her husband continues. They were willing to get rid of their brother, and look how far she goes. So the contrast isn't between Yosef and Yehuda. Maybe the contrast is between Tamar and the brothers, right? And maybe even Tamar and Yaakov, because Yaakov's actions were, the consequence of Yaakov's actions put, his own children in peril, his own son in peril.
Yeah.
And she's doing the exact opposite, going such a far distance in order to ensure. So I'm going to add this to our list over here. Okay. Judy makes it to the board. Okay. There we go. I guess we should put Paula here also. All right. So everybody has fair representation. Okay. So I think that is correct. That if you take a look at it from Tamar's perspective, so Tamar stands as a contrast either to the brothers, how they conducted themselves with Yosef, or as a contrast to Yaakov and how he conducted him and how he his actions put his own son in peril. Okay, I want to take a look at one more thing here. This fellow by the name of Rabbi David Kasher, who I happen to know, writes, opposes this question, and he cites Rashi, and he says there are two answers of Rashi. And I looked in the Rashi, and maybe it's in a different place, but I don't see it in this Rashi. Maybe if you see it, you let me know. And I looked in another version of Rashi. I didn't see it there, so I'm just now I took this off the shelf because I realized we have this linear Rashi here, which is really significant Rashi. So just take a quick look to see if they have it here. So there's apparently a second answer of Rashi, which I will read for you in a moment. And I'm just going to see if it's in this section. And again, maybe I missed it. You'll tell me if I missed it. All right. So let's see here. Take a look here at Rashi. Ahi bayitahi, lamanis mecha, amrata machart. No, I don't see it in this either. Okay, but Rabbi Kasher has a second answer of Rashi, which maybe it's in a different place in the Parsha. I didn't see it. But listen to the second answer of Rashi. Rashi says, "Va'od." Furthermore, the reason that this story of Yehuda and Tamar is inserted here, says Rashi, "Kidei lismoch ma'ase ishto shel Potifar lema'ase Tamar." Right? In order to contrast, listen carefully, because it's not exactly the same thing of what we just said. To contrast the story of the wife of Potiphar with the story of Tamar, which is not exactly what Paula and Ibn Ezra are saying. Listen carefully. Lomar lach, to say to you, ma zo l'shem shamayim, sorry, not a contrast, a comparison. Lomar lach, to say, ma zo l'shem shamayim, avzo l'shem shamayim. To make the point that just like Tamar was pure of heart and pure of thought and pure of mind when she went down this path to sleep with her father-in-law, kach shirasa b'tristrologin shela sh'atida lahamid banim mimenu v'ina yodati mimena imbita. Just as Tamar was pure of thought, the wife of Potiphar also was seducing Yosef for pure intentions.
All right, there were stories that she wanted.
What?
There were stories that she also saw something in her stars.
Right. So that's what we just read over here, Rashi, that she sees in the future, she'atida lahamid banim, that from her children will come forth, ve'ena yoda'at im mimena im mibita. She just wasn't sure if from this union of Yosef and her family, that union was going to be her and her between Yosef and her,
to Yosef and her daughter. Ultimately, Yosef ends up marrying Osnat, which is the daughter of Eshes Potiphar.
Right.
Okay, or daughter of Potiphar. Right. So, let's think about this for a second. It says the story of Yehuda and Tamar is for us to know that the wife of Potiphar was acting only with the purest of motives. That's like crazy almost. I don't want to say crazy, but that's shocking. It's power. What does that even mean? That's why this story is here. The story of Yehuda and Tamar is here in order to show that the seductress of the story of Yosef was not really a terrible person. And Yosef, actually, I mean, if that's true, that she was acting with the purest of intentions, so, you know, Yosef's act of rebuffing her becomes less, I don't want to say less heroic, because from his perspective it was heroic, but, you know, it wasn't like she was, you know, trying to do him ill in this version. And then it turns out that this story of Yehuda and Tamar is here in order to give a nice take on Eshes Potiphar. That's why this is here? So we should look at Eshes Potiphar better? What does that even mean?
But if she had these pure motives and these pure intentions, she was a married woman.
And she's not supposed
so
to
be. So when you go to seduce yourself with a pure saying to seduce and have that followed by anything other than her husband is already places her in the bottom of some moral code.
Okay, so you're furthering the question.
Bathsheba, you're not supposed to act on those notions. You're supposed to let things take their course.
Take their natural course.
Right. Yeah, so.
Okay. So.
What's your question? Because it's different. Right. What's your question
here? I'm saying that if this that if this is really the answer, you know, I find that rather problematic.
Oh, so you don't like this answer?
So,
but, I mean.
If that's the question, then there's an answer to it. And right. None of this is it.
Right. Okay, so. Before we move on from this and get to our closing segment, can anybody, you know, want to defend or come up with an idea that might retain this as a, you know, very viable answer? I mean, apparently Rashi says it, so it's a viable answer. But you know, is there a compelling explanation that this whole story here is in order to defend the wife of Potiphar?
Is the wife of Potiphar given any place of recognition among the Mephoreshim other than what you told us today?
I mean, I don't think so. I'm not sure if, but I don't think so. I don't think so.
I mean, it's a pretty major concept that you're suggesting with, you know, pulling this together. It's not been picked up by anybody else. The
right.
Doesn't even point the finger and say, it's sort of like, here's 6,000 puzzle pieces, put it together and you will figure out the importance of Potiphar's wife.
Right. So even, now we do have, let's use that as a stepping stone to the final point here. There is a Medrash. The one that I have for you, I think I photocopied the wrong one. One second. I didn't photocopy the right medrash. Okay, but there is a medrash that says the following. Why are these stories next to one another? So Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yochanan say the following. Rabbi Eliezer, says, "Kidei lismoch yirida liyirida." The purpose of the stories is about Yehuda's descent and Yosef's descent. Yehuda descends because he was deposed. Yosef descends because Yehuda basically deposed him. You know, caused his descent. Okay, we spoke about that. Rabbi Yochanan says, "Kidei lismoch." Haker la haker.
Rabbi Yochanan says, just like Yehuda was bested by Tamar when she showed him the harlot's ring, so similarly, what's the other haker? When the brothers take the sheep, the cloak with the bloodied cloak, they say to Yaakov, haker, do you recognize this? So there's somehow a connection between Yaakov recognizing the cloak and Yehuda recognizing the Yehuda recognizing the ring and the staff. Okay, and then Rav Shmuel Bar Nachman, the third opinion is k'dei lismoch maaseh Tamar l'maaseh ishto shel Potifar, in order to connect the story of Eshes Potifar to the story of Tamar, right? Either maybe contrasting it the way we had it over here, like Polo was saying, or comparing it like that version in Rashi. At the end of the day, what we have here are, if you think about it, two overall issues that came up in Yaakov's life that are now being revisited in later generations. And they are, what are the two big issues in Yaakov's life that define his life? So the Leah and the Rachel story, his problem with his intimate relations, his intimate relationship, where he tried to marry Rachel, he had to marry Leah, marry Rachel, right? So, and Esav, right? So the two significant things here are who is going to be the Bechor, who's going to be the proper leader of the family, and who is, and how, and the intimate relationship between himself and his beloved. Or now those two ideas, and again, I offer this up from Rabbi Kasher's insight, that although I'm not saying it exactly the way he did, that these two ideas manifest themselves again in the life of the next generation, right? Yosef, right, has issue with the wife of Potiphar. Yehuda, right, has with Tamar. So we have the sexual issue, the intimate relationship issue re-emerging in the later generation, and we have the issue of Bechira, of who is going to be the leader, and that emerges both within Yosef being sold to Mitzrayim. Yosef's two children, Ephraim and Menashe, right? Remember, they cross the hands. Well, which one is going? Which one gets the bracha? And we have it with Yehuda and Yosef. Like, so Yehuda is the leader, but maybe Yosef is supposed to be the leader. So we have this contest going on in leadership between Yehuda and Yosef. And then we have Yehuda's own children, Zerach and Peretz, where one emerges from the room, from the womb, and then gets pulled back. So we have these two themes of the intimate relations issue, and who's going to lead the tribe issue, and that is a defining characteristic of Yaakov, problematically so, and it reemerges again in the next generation. So where does this all end us up? Where does this all get us? So I think it gets us to the following point. Both of these are resolved. Both of these are resolved in the next generation, right? Yehuda. Let's deal with the wives issue first. So Yosef the son is tempted by Eshes Potiphar, and he resists that temptation, and he ultimately marries the woman who he's supposed to marry, and that issue of the life of Yaakov sort of sees a resolution and a correction, a tikkun, if you will, in the life of Yosef. You might even argue that it sees resolution in the life of Yehuda as well.
because even though Yehuda acts inappropriately to begin with, ultimately, when presented with the facts, he embraces the truth, and he embraces his wife, right? He embraces Tamar. Now, Leah, you know, sort of, I think, always ends up as a rejected soul, even though he has many children with her. But I think the feel of the story is that, you know, Leah is, you know, remains, is second citizen, right? Even when Yaakov regrets the fact that he didn't bury Rachel in Mara Samach Pela like he buried Leah, you know, like we don't see, like, when Leah dies, you know, any type of, you know, like, where's the funeral for Leah? Like, we don't have it. When Rachel dies, you know, there's mention of it. Right? Even though we spoke about last week, it's cryptic. So both of these seem to be resolved in the the story of Yaakov and Rachel and Leah seem to find resolution in the story of Yehuda and Tamar and set the stage for the future of the Jewish people, as well as the story of whose leadership is taking, who's the bechor, who's the leader, that also finds resolution in the story of Yehuda and Tamar, because the first child emerges his hand from the womb, and they tie a crimson string around the child, and then the hand gets pulled back in, and then the other child is born first. It's like Esav and Yaakov all over again, except for, you know, the hand didn't come out first. But Yaakov is supposed to be, you know, born first, but his brother, right? Esav is supposed to be born first, but, you know, Yaakov is holding on to his heel. So here you have the resolution of the Yaakov Esav thing that, you know, Yaakov maybe inappropriately, you know, as we know the story, and he sells the bechorah and he steals the bracha, you know, all peepshat, and maybe these are all defensible in one way or another. But even if they're all defensible in one way or another, they still leave a stain. Like I think Rabbi Schiffman was mentioning the other day, I think Rabbi Schiffman mentioned it in one of his shiurim the other day that, you know, even if you are allowed to kill in war. Yaakov is right. The story of Yaakov meeting up with his brother Esav. So it says, "Vayitzer lo." He was very nervous about this confrontation. So what was he nervous about? So Mefarshim explain he was nervous about the fact that he would have to kill somebody. You're nervous about the fact you're in war. What are you going to do in war other than kill people? You're not having tea or crumpets. The answer is, even if it is legitimate and even if it's defensible, as I mentioned before. Like Golda Meir famously said about the Palestinians and the Arabs more generally, he says, we can forgive them for killing our children, but we cannot forgive them for making our children have to kill.
Into killers.
What? I'm just saying that the idea that even if killing is justifiable and you have to do it, it still leaves a scar. It leaves something. I talk to anybody who's been a soldier in war that they killed. You know, it's not nothing. It leaves an impression. What? And more. So, you know, even if everything that Yaakov did is entirely defensible and you can give all the reasons in the world why Yaakov had to do this and Yaakov had to do that. But in the end, he did these things. And it leaves a mark. In Yehuda and Tamar, in this story, we get the resolution. We reset the stage, and we reset the path. We rewrite the path. So you're going down the straight path now. Yehuda and Tamar, in their story, through Peretz and Zerach, the notion of who becomes the first child, there's no question. A crimson string was tied around the child, and even though the other one came out first, we figured out who the right one is.
But who was Peretz? Because he broke first.
Okay, but we know who is who. right? In other words, there is clarity. There is clarity about who is supposed to be the firstborn. Let me just finish up because I ran a little over time. So at the end of the day, look what happens to the offspring from Yehuda and Tamar. Right? Let's get back to where Briny started us, which is that ultimately the redemption comes from this union. The redemption comes from this union. David HaMelech ultimately comes from the union of Yehuda and Tamar, which is both the which brings us to the leadership of the Jewish people, right? That is permanently resolved, right? And the strain of Yaakov and Rachel and Leah, that's also resolved through the Yehuda Tamar relationship. So if you ask the question, what does and once that is resolved, it is through that resolved relationship of husband and wife that, you know, David HaMelech ultimately emerges, and of course that means Mashiach ultimately emerges. So these two things had to be righted in the history of the Jewish people, in the history of the house of Jacob, the relationship of the wives on the one hand, and the Bechira, figuring out who's going to be the first in line, and managing the relationship between brothers. Once those are resolved, it is through that line that ultimately ultimate redemption can ultimately emerge. And so if you ask the question, why is the Yehuda Tamar interlude here? So the real answer is that it's not an interlude. It is precisely the necessary step which is required in order to bring the future of the Jewish people to fruition. That's what we have. Okay. So, Mirtz Hashem, next week is Hanukkah. We will meet same time, same place.